Bonjour. Ladies and gentlemen, honored colleagues, I am very happy to be here to talk on this topic of scribality, orality, and writing, a topic very interesting to me for a long time. And what I want to talk today about is how writing, particularly the writing of literary theological works like the Gilgamesh epic or the Bible, functioned culturally in the ancient world, much like knowledge of French and French literature long has, or English does to some extent today. Particularly in the 19th century, many aristocratic elites from Britain to Russia and beyond were educated in French and French literature in order to claim an educated, cultured status within a European world where French was the de facto lingua franca, so to speak, of the upper classes. Within that period and beyond, French has functioned as an international currency with which people have purchased cultural prestige. And education in French, and now English, has been a means for educated people across the world to obtain such cultural linguistic currency. It was not just a tool for communication. It was a tool to gain cultural prestige. Today, using examples drawn from my current research on Genesis 1 through 4, I will argue that these chapters in the Bible illustrate how the writing of these kinds of literary theological texts was part of an attempt of Israelite elites to imitate and claim for themselves some of the cultural prestige of literary theological scribalism of older empires of the region in Egypt and especially Mesopotamia. Writing within polities like Judah was a currency with which these polities could purchase cultural prestige for themselves. A political structure like the Davidic dynasty and the Jerusalem stronghold or the Amorite dynasty in Samaria might be a far cry from the great city-based monarchies of Egypt or Mesopotamia. Nevertheless, the Israelite and Judean monarchs still claimed a measure of the prestige of these more famous empires by developing their own imitative, memory-oriented scribal systems and oral-written literary theological literatures. Literatures partly modeled on and yet distinguished from the literary theological literatures of Egypt and Mesopotamia. The Hebrew Bible is a deposit of the results of this initially imitative project of gaining cultural prestige. And I aim today to illustrate this thesis through drawing on the preliminary results of my current research on Genesis 1 through 4 for a commentary that I'm writing now on Genesis 1 through 11. Now, before saying more about Genesis, let me discuss a few features of the imperial scribal systems on which it is dependent. And here I will briefly summarize some earlier work that I did on oral written scribal systems of Egypt and Mesopotamia. Because I want to wish to concentrate on echoes of these scribal systems in Genesis 1 to 4, my summary consists of four broad generalizations, each of which build on work by specialists in other fields, some of whom are on the program for this conference and cited in my book, Writing in the Tablet of the Heart, Origins of Scripture and Literature. First, writing in the ancient Near East, including Judah and Israel, was a competence possessed only by a small minority of the population, and it was used for quite different specific purposes. This idea that literacy was quite limited is not only true for societies like Egypt or Mesopotamia with complex sign systems, but also for societies like Israel that used alphabets, especially if we're talking about literacy in reading extended writings like the Bible. And this leads to my second point. My focus here is on the development and use of what I'll be terming literary theological texts. This term is a useful umbrella, I think, to characterize the often religiously tinged literary corpora of the Near East and to distinguish such literary theological texts from other kinds of writing in the ancient world, such as documentary records of transactions, letters, magic or ritual texts, such as we heard about yesterday, legal contracts, memorial and/or dedicatory inscriptions. As we've seen in excellent lectures already given at the conference here, such texts have their own blend of orality and writing, but I'm suggesting that these blends are different than for the literary theological texts I'm discussing today. Third, such literary theological texts were used for education. More specifically, they were used for the learning of such literary theological works helped enculturate and mark off priests, military officials, royal bureaucrats, and others as a special class of literate elites. Thus, such education in written texts was not done because such jobs particularly required writing. Instead, most literary theological texts focused on archaic topics and were written in languages or dialects no longer in general use. In sum, these texts were generally impractical. My fourth point is that it's implicit in the above, but needs to be underlined. This special knowledge, the literacy that marked off such elites, was not mere knowledge of reading and writing. Rather, writing was a means by which such elites learned these often obscure texts and languages, by which they memorized them. Written copies of ancient texts like Gilgamesh helped ancient students memorize the wholly obscure texts of their tradition and work with Near Eastern textual traditions by Paul De Niro, who talked earlier today, and others, has found variants between copies of literary theological texts that are most typical of memory variation, and I've found those also within the Hebrew Bible. These variants show that the text copyists had memorized such texts through reading, copying, and reciting them. They, quote, wrote them on the tablets of their heart. And we find this versions of this expression cross-culturally across Mesopotamia, Egypt, Greece, and also Israel. In this way, writing was intimately bound up with verbatim memorization of ancient texts along with oral performance. Orality and performance, in other words, was not opposed to writing. Rather, in the case of literary theological texts used for education, writing was intimately bound up with memorization and oral performance. Thus, this triad, writing, memorization, and orality, must be constantly kept in mind in studying literary theological texts like the Bible. Moreover, memorization must not be specifically linked to orality, as it often is, but should also be seen as a crucial part of written literacy as well. It's not as elegant, but I'd suggest rather than talking about a move from orality to writing, at least in the case of literary theological text, we'd focus instead on a move from a dyad of orality memorization to a triad of orality memorization writing, at least for the text I'm talking about today. So much for my summary of past research. My main focus now is illustrating, with reference to Genesis 1-4, how the Hebrew Bible betrays a complex relation to these foreign systems of oral, written, scribal education. These chapters in the Bible well illustrate how the indigenous Israelite scribal system imitated elements of these foreign scribal systems, in this case particularly in Mesopotamia, including their focus on memorization of ancient texts through the use of orality and writing. And here I'll be summarizing the preliminary results of my commentary. I start with the story of human creation and maturing in Genesis 2-3. This highly etiological story lacks any exact equivalent in the scribal curricula of the ancient Near East. In a minute, I'll talk more about why. Nevertheless, a closer look at Genesis 2-3 reveals how the Garden of Eden story echoes numerous Mesopotamian traditions as it provides its own account of how humans gained wisdom and lost a chance at immortality. Now, there are more themes that link the stories than I can discuss here, such as the broader Mesopotamian idea of humans being created for hard farming work or cosmological schemes in Mesopotamia that start with a naked, immature humans who then gain clothing and civilization. But I'll focus here on how, for example, where the Gilgamesh epic shows Gilgamesh losing the plant of eternal youth to a skin-changing snake. The Garden of Eden story features a wise snake who prompts the humans to eat forbidden fruit and thus be forever expelled from the garden containing the tree of immortality. Their unknowing loss of a chance to eat the fruit of this tree of immortality in Genesis 2-3 resembles Oedipus' ignorant refusal to eat the food and drink of immortality offered to him by the gods and Oedipus, including, incidentally, a snake deity. These and other texts treat a similar question of how humans are both wise and mortal, and they revolve around similar themes and, incidentally, similarly feature snakes, who are widespread symbols of immortality because of their changing skin. Nevertheless, the connections between these texts are complex, and they do not overlap in any extended section. Genesis 2 to 3 is no exegesis of Gilgamesh, Oedipus, or any other text, even though those texts actually were written down and copies were in circulation at some point in the region of Palestine, though it's hard to know the point of connection to Israelite tradition. Instead, the more fluid and distant echoes of Mesopotamian texts in Genesis 2 to 3 likely betray some sort of engagement with them via memory at some stage in the transmission process, and you can hear my qualifications there. Genesis 1. The majestic seven-day account of God's creation in Genesis 1 likewise shows links to the Mesopotamian scribal tradition, this time particularly the Enuma Elish epic that was widely circulated, performed, and echoed in Mesopotamian literature, particularly in the mature period. The focus of Genesis 1 on demonstrating God's power through God's sovereign control over creation resembles the focus of the Enuma Elish epic on demonstrating Marduk's supremacy over the other gods through his creative and other powers. More specifically, the description of God's creation of the cosmos in Genesis 1 features many of the same elements that occur in the description of Marduk's creation of the cosmos. Marduk's splitting of the upper and lower oceans through erecting a dome out of parts of Tiamat's body, his organization of the world waters, his creation of the heavenly bodies and placement of them in the dome to mark omena and various seasons, his creation of humanity after consultation with Ea. Furthermore, there are certain blind motifs from Enuma Elish that appear relatively isolated in Genesis 1, particularly the description of God's creation of a massive dome in Genesis 1 that separates the two oceans without attention in Genesis to what it's made of, or the brief and undeveloped mention of signs at the outset of the purpose of heavenly bodies in Genesis 1 that corresponds to the much more developed and astral emphasis on oracular signs in Enuma Elish, and the passing reference to God's creation of sea monsters in Genesis 1:21 that may echo mention of Tiamat. This listing of connections to Enuma Elish, however, also points to profound ways in which Genesis 1 represents a resistant counter-presentation to Enuma Elish rather than a mere extension or allusion to it. Some Assyrian versions of Enuma Elish, for example, merely substitute the Assyrian state god Ashur for Marduk. Genesis 1, in contrast, transforms and counters basic elements of the popular Mesopotamian epic, yet does not once cite or specifically echo it. For example, the entire polytheistic scenery of the Enuma Elish, so central to the theme of Marduk's supremacy over and recognition as king by other gods, is completely absent in the resolutely monotheistic Genesis 1 creation account. Moreover, there's no reflection in Genesis 1 of the theme of divine conflict that takes up the majority of the tablets in the Enuma Elish. And Genesis 1 never once uses vocabulary specific to kingship, despite its thoroughgoing depiction of God as in supreme control, and also Genesis 1's echo of royal theology in depicting humans as created as the image of their king-like deity in order to rule. These elliptical connections to themes of kingship in Genesis 1 contrast with the frequent explicit emphasis in the Enuma Elish on Marduk as king. In sum, Genesis 1, like Genesis 2 to 3, betrays multiple and often specific linkages to a prominent precursor written text in the Mesopotamian scribal tradition. Nevertheless, its relation to that text is also profoundly fluid, and in this case, polemical. In this way, Genesis 1 exemplifies a more critical stance toward extra-biblical precursors than is evident in Genesis 2 to 3, one probably prompted by and the likely setting of the composition of Genesis 1 in Babylonian exile after the Babylonian destruction of Jerusalem. Genesis 4. I could go on to describe other echoes of Mesopotamian and Egyptian scribal traditions in Genesis 1 to 11, but I want to focus here with my remaining time on a way Genesis 1 to 4, particularly Genesis 4, illustrates the written textualization of originally oral traditions, something even more evident in latter parts of Genesis 12 through 50. My brief summary of a complicated argument here may be a bit compact, but please bear with me. I suggest that the story of Cain and Abel in Genesis 4 provides one of the best examples in the primeval history of the written formulation of what was originally and exclusively oral tradition. Where Genesis 1 and 2 to 3 appear to build particularly on parallels in Near Eastern literature, this story in Genesis 4 has its closest analogs in biblical traditions about the origins of peoples and tribes and brotherly conflict that we see more prominently represented in the latter half of Genesis. Moreover, there are several signs that the bulk of Genesis 4 originated in a earlier non-cosmogonic tradition about Cain and his descendants up through Lamech. The clearest indicators of this are the way multiple parts of the tradition, such as Cain's statement of worry that other people will murder him, or Yahweh's promise that anyone who kills him will have their kin killed as well, or the report of Cain taking a wife. All of these elements seem to presuppose the existence of more humans on earth than would be expected in a story about the brothers in the first human family. To these could be added the unusual level of incongruities in Genesis 4, 1 to 24, some of which may point to a secondary appropriation in this chapter of a tradition, including, for example, the reference toward the end of the Cain-Abel story to a sign that God gives Cain that marks him as protected by God. And this sign isn't further specified in the text. It appears to be presupposed as known by its audience and was probably connected by that audience with the Kenites, who were a people with a name resembling Cain, the character Cain in the story, and this people was associated with metalworking and tent dwelling that's associated with Cain's descendant Lamech. Such an etiology of the Kenites, would have been quite short, and it would not, and it would not have been the type of text, literary theological text at least, likely to have been inscribed and circulated on a separate piece of written media, whether scroll or potsherd. Rather, like the etiologies of Israelite tribes and non-Israelite peoples standing behind other narratives in Genesis 12 to 50, the pre-biblical tradition I'm discussing here about Cain and his descendants was likely circulated in exclusively oral form before it was adapted for use in its present cosmogonic context as a sequel to the Garden of Eden story. As such, Genesis 4 is a good example of a broader phenomenon in the Hebrew Bible, the production of parts of Judah's literary theological corpus through the adaptation and writing down of indigenous, originally oral traditions. Indeed, I would argue that the Cain-Abel portion of the Cain-Lamech tradition in Genesis 4 likely served as a model for much of the Garden of Eden story in Genesis 2 to 3. Scholars have long observed numerous parallels between the Eden story and the Cain and Abel story. And theoretically, such parallels between these stories could have been produced through one author writing both stories from scratch, or having the Cain and Abel story be modeled on its Eden precursor. Nevertheless, I suggest that the above-mentioned signs of an earlier tradition behind the Cain-Abel story suggest that this Cain-Lamech tradition was the point of origin for many of the motifs now shared across Genesis 2 through 4, where Cain's murder of his brother Abel stands at the center of Genesis 4, 3 to 16. The author of Genesis 2 to 4 made the Eden story revolve around the eating of forbidden fruit. And where Yahweh's provision for Cain after punishment is prompted by Cain's extended protest in Genesis 4, 13 to 14, the author of Genesis 2 to 3 had God's pronouncement of punishment in that story be followed by Yahweh's gracious provision of durable clothes for humans in Genesis 3, 21. In these and other ways, motifs that probably had their original home in the Cain-Lamech oral tradition were the template for the creation of a corresponding Eden story that now precedes the Cain-Lamech story in Genesis 4. Thus, the author of Genesis 2 to 4 drew on elements of an early Cain-Abel story in crafting the story of the Garden of Eden, and then continued with a written version of that story in Genesis 4. This then would refine our understanding of how the Garden of Eden story is related to non-Israelite texts whose themes it echoes. Genesis 2 to 3 reflects a complex mix of a distinctively Israelite tale of disobedience and expulsion, which was drawn from the Cain-Lamech tradition, with international scribal themes of wisdom, immortality, and the maturing of humanity. In summary, I'm suggesting that the earliest semi-reconstructible tradition behind Genesis 1 to 4 is at the top of this slide, and it was an exclusively oral tradition about Cain and his descendants up through Lamech, a tradition that purported to provide the origins and characteristics of the Kenites. Then below the line, which represents the beginning of transmission of these traditions through writing, the author of Genesis 2:4b through 4:24 drew on this oral tradition about Cain and Abel in the process of producing a written cosmology that also echoed texts in the Mesopotamian scribal curriculum that circulated at least at some points in the Levant, such as Gilgamesh and Adapa. Meanwhile, I've suggested that the cosmogony of Genesis 1, going further down the slide, likewise represents a Judean engagement with the oral written scribal tradition of Mesopotamia, this time in polemical rejection of the claims for Marduk's supremacy in the Enuma Elish epic. Notably, it appears that these different generations of Israelite scribes worked far more fluidly with elements of written non-biblical texts, such as Gilgamesh or Enuma Elish, that they engaged, than they seem to have done in the case of their appropriation and use of a likely oral tradition about Kenites, now detectable behind Genesis 4. The present form of Genesis 1 to 4, of course, represents a written combination of Genesis 1, 1 through 2, 3, and 2, 4b through 4, 24, and that's the bottom of the slide. Nevertheless, by this time, the time the combination was done, Judean scribes appear to have limited themselves to coordinating pre-existing written traditions rather than productively adding to them. Thus, the Genesis 1, 1 through 2, 3 cosmogony was linked to the Garden of Eden story through the addition of a small textual bridge at the seam between the two, a superscription in Genesis 2:4a that identifies what follows as concerning the outcomes or origins of heaven and earth. Then the Genesis 4 Cain-Lamech genealogy was coordinated with the following genealogy of Seth in Genesis 5 through the addition of a preliminary Sethite genealogy in 4:25 to 26, modeled on the birth reports found in the preceding text. The type of authorship evident in these coordinating elements is limited and derivative, and it appears that, at least in terms of the textual tradition for Genesis, these chapters were quite stable. In fact, I was hoping they'd be more fluid when I proposed the topic for this conference, but they're very stable. At most, early manuscripts of Genesis betray occasional scribal interventions by way of harmonizing coordinations of the stories in the chapters, these harmonizations being one of the most common ways that scribes almost hyper-memorized the textual traditions they copied. Thus, I'm saying there's a meaningful distinction, at least for Genesis, toward the beginning of the Bible, between engagement of foreign, especially Mesopotamian, oral written scribal systems in earlier stages of the formation of Genesis, and then later, a more localized and preservative oral written form of Judean scribality that we see in the final formation of Genesis and the combination of the traditions and harmonization of them. In these earlier stages, we do see a fluid engagement by Judean and Israelite scribes with foreign literary theological traditions across both non-priestly and priestly traditions. Those scribes engage such foreign traditions both by adding writing to the oral memory dyad for transmission of literary traditions, and they also drew specifically on some themes from foreign streams of tradition in formulating these stories. Yet there came a point, at least with these earlier chapters of Genesis, where these oral written memorized texts were indeed fixed by means of writing. And this meant that scribal productivity was limited initially to combining the stories and then to just transmitting them occasionally with harmonizing additions. Within biblical scholarship, people often describe discuss these sorts of elements as borrowing or influence. But the point I'm meaning to make here is that Genesis 1 to 4 was formed within Israelite and Judean struggles for cultural integrity and prestige. This kind of writing in the Near Eastern context is not a neutral medium, but a mark of power. Scribalism was not just about processing and producing texts, but about the production of elite social classes and the promotion of their claims to supremacy. And the themes found in texts like Gilgamesh were not mere models for biblical texts. Rather, Gilgamesh and other literary theological texts in the stream of tradition were associated with the prestige and claims to power of the older empires with which they were associated. Thus, the writing of Hebrew literary theological texts was an act of power, one involving the development of a hybrid Hebrew oral written scribalism, a scribalism imitative of and yet distinct from the more famous oral written scribal systems on which it was modeled. In my book, Writing on the Tablet of the Heart, I'd argued that Mesopotamian and Egyptian scribal systems were relevant to the study of biblical scribalism because they are better documented, and that is indeed true. But here I go further to more clearly emphasize that the oral written scribal systems of Egypt and Mesopotamia are also important because of the way they appear to have been models for the Judeo-Israelite scribal system. And herein also lies an important distinction of style, of scale and type of scribal system. The scribal systems of Egypt and Mesopotamia each had their own rationale within these larger cultures, administering large empires and employing huge numbers of scribes. In contrast, in and of itself, there likely was little need for such elite oral written scribal systems within the modest context of small regional powers like Judah or Israel or other Levantine cities. But for such polities to have their claim to fame, they too needed to have their own court scribes and scribal curricula. Sadly, we do not have much remaining of most such imitative, localized scribal systems of Levantine cities, since they, like Judah and Israel, wrote literary theological texts on perishable scrolls. Instead, aside from texts like the Ugaritic Corpus, Moabite Stela, and Deir Allah inscription, the Hebrew Bible, with texts like Genesis 1 to 4, is our most complete example of hybrid local mimicry of the larger scale oral written scribal systems of the great Near Eastern empires. Thank you for your attention.